Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please.
Call for the argument. Before we begin, I guess I should note that you only see two of us sitting up here. Because Judge Griffith is invisible, he is attending the arguments by telephone connection to Utah, where it's probably cooler than it is here, but we have a beautiful day here too, Judge Griffith. So
it's cooler and it's quite dark still.
Okay, well, it's sunny and bright here and a very nice day.
Glad to be with you.
And you.
Case number 051462 et al. Louisiana Public Service Commission Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Issue jurisdiction. Mr. Longstreth for AEEC, Ms. Perry for FERC.
Thank you, Your Honor. Arkansas Electric Energy Consumers is a nonprofit corporation whose members are industrial and agricultural users of electricity. AEC's members and other Arkansas ratepayers will ultimately be asked to pay the cost of the FERC orders under review here. The question in this portion of the argument is whether the Commission has jurisdiction to be in the highly unusual business of ordering one state, in this case Arkansas, to send the benefits of its lower cost electricity production, primarily used to serve retail customers, to other states. First, we are not asking this panel to reverse this court's decision in the Mississippi Industries case, and this court need not do so. We believe that the FERC has gone far beyond what was at issue there, and that there are significant differences between this case and that case that the Commission has not acknowledged or addressed. In particular, Mississippi Industries involved sales that were entirely at wholesale and made by a single entity. Here, the sales the Commission is addressing in its remedy are mostly retail sales, and the single entity issue creates a real problem for the Commission. Unlike Mississippi Industries, this case involves allocation of the costs of five separate public utilities that the Commission has treated as a single company for some purposes and as separate companies for other purposes. And also, unlike Mississippi Industries, the Commission's result depends on an improper attempt to have it both ways. In Mississippi Industries, all of the sales at issue were wholesale sales made by a single company, Middle South Energy, which owned and financed the Grand Gulf nuclear plant at issue in that case. This court stated, quote, MSE sales are without exception at wholesale and in interstate commerce. The court found that FERC had jurisdiction over those wholesale sales and then could also allocate the cost of those sales within the system. To fit into the Mississippi Industries precedent here, FERC starts out treating the operating companies as if they were a single company, using the system agreement as a jurisdictional toehold, and asserts that the agreement is discriminatory because it allows that single company to treat Arkansas better than Louisiana. But the companies are not a single entity. They're five separate public utilities. Each remains separately responsible and subject to state regulation for constructing, financing, and operating the plants. Each has its own board of directors. Each has its own corporate structure. The Commission has thus been required to pierce their separate corporate veils to treat them as a separate entity, but has not met the high standards that are required under the law to do so. And the Commission has recognized those standards in a prior case where they've refused to pierce the corporate veil to treat a power pool as a single entity so that its costs would all be equalized. And that's the Georgia Power case at 52. Federal Power 1348-1349, and they reaffirmed that decision involving the Southern companies in 1991 after the Grand Gulf case was decided. That's at 54 FERC 63007. So this is the first time that the FERC has taken the position that because an entity operates as a single power pool, FERC has jurisdiction to equalize the costs over all of those companies. I think the logic of the Commission's position is also brought into focus if you realize that if, in fact, these energy companies were a single entity, then the sales that are at issue here would not be jurisdictional sales. They would be intercompany transfers between those companies, and they would, if it were a single company, these are all sales primarily at issue here that are retail sales, and FERC would not have jurisdiction to equalize the cost associated with them. So you have a situation where, on the one hand, FERC is treating the companies as a single company in order to find discrimination, but in order to get jurisdiction to find that they're wholesale sales between the companies, they have to treat them as separate companies, and we think that that is illogical and arbitrary and capricious. I think it's also important to recognize that the effect of the Commission's improper assertion of jurisdiction is to impose a remedy that, even under the Commission's approach, applies overwhelmingly to retail and not to wholesale sales. Unlike the Grand Gulf case, where the allocation...
Yeah, Counsel, you said it's primarily retail and overwhelmingly retail, but you do acknowledge that there is a wholesale component here. Is that correct?
There are wholesale sales. The sales between the entities are wholesale sales, but FERC's remedy is not limited only to those wholesale sales. What FERC is seeking the authority to do here is to equalize all of the production costs through the system.
Yeah, but under 201A, FERC clearly has jurisdiction over wholesale sales in interstate commerce, right? And you're acknowledging that there are some wholesale sales in interstate commerce, correct?
There are some wholesale sales here in interstate commerce, and FERC could act with respect to those wholesale sales, but they're not acting merely with respect to those wholesale sales. They're equalizing the entire costs under the system. I think the Conway case that we cited talks about this issue as well. That was a case, it was a price squeeze case, but it was a case where both wholesale and retail sales were involved. FERC was allowed to take the retail sales into account when setting the wholesale rates, but FERC could act only on the wholesale rates, not on the retail rates. And in this particular case, given the very small proportion of sales in this system that are in fact wholesale sales, really the effect of FERC's remedy, given its magnitude, is to...
You're through answering the question and back to arguing, and you are out of time, so...
Okay.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, then we'll hear from the respondent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Morning, Ms. Berry.
Good morning, Your Honors. As the Commission found in 480 and 480A, this attack is basically on Mississippi Industries. The Mississippi Industries controls the question here. Mississippi Industries found that it was jurisdictional under this same system agreement for the Commission to allocate generation cost as a cost component affecting wholesale rates. There's no distinction between Mississippi Industries and the facts at issue here, and therefore, as the Commission found in 480A at paragraph 100, the Commission was unable to act inconsistently with Mississippi Industries and exercise jurisdiction in this case.
What do you say to their argument that this case involves fewer wholesale sales than was true in Mississippi Industries?
I don't understand why there's a distinction between what happened here and what happened in Mississippi Industries, because in Mississippi Industries, what the Commission was doing was allocating the costs of the nuclear investment. And in here, what the Commission is doing is allocating the costs, the wholesale production costs. But in either event, ultimately, those costs go through to the retail ratepayers. I mean, there's no difference here between the nuclear and the production costs in terms of what happens to them eventually. They all go through to the retail ratepayers. So I don't see that there's any distinction. And as a matter of fact, in Mississippi Industries, and in 234 and 292, the Commission and this Court rejected the argument that there was any distinction between the nuclear generation that was being allocated in that case and any other generation on the system. And you can see that at 808 Fed Second at 1556, and also 292 41 FERC at 61618. In 234, 31 FERC at 61651. So the conclusion was there is nothing distinct about the generation costs that were being allocated in Mississippi Industries.
It's an integrated system then, it's an integrated system now.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Because the generation is built on an integrated basis, the commission may allocate it as a cost component affecting wholesale rates. That was the finding in Mississippi Industries, and that was the finding that the commission based its jurisdiction on here.
All right.
Any further questions?
Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I call the next argument.
Remedy, Mr. Fonthen for LPSC, Ms. Cochran for APSC/MPSC, Mr. Longstreth for AEEC, Ms. Perry for FERC, Mr. Anderson for Entergy.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Fonthen. I represent the Louisiana Public Service Commission. I've asked to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. In this case,
watch it for yourself. We're not good at saving it for you. So go ahead.
Okay, I'll try.
Okay.
In this case, the FERC ruled that there are no cost causation differences and says in its brief that there are no dissimilar circumstances among the operating companies on the energy system, and therefore each company is responsible for causing an identical amount of production cost on a cost-adjusted kilowatt-hour basis. And yet the FERC, in enacting an undue discrimination standard, permitted differences of plus or minus 11%, hundreds of millions of dollars, which the FERC in its brief describes as enormous, massive, and in the order of an amount that would produce rate shock, which necessarily means that it has left in place discrimination that is massive, enormous, and produces rate shock to the higher cost company. The FERC did this for the sole remaining purpose, because all their grounds were withdrawn on rehearing except one, the sole remaining purpose of mitigating the cost shifts that are always part of remedying discrimination. I'd like to address.
Let me make sure I understand what you're addressing. Are you talking about the breadth of the belt, or are you talking about the timing?
I'm talking about the breadth of the belt right now. It's plus or minus 11%. Each percentage point is on the order of $13 to $15 million. So a below cost company can be $130 or $150 million below average. A high cost country
now
company.
You would concede that they don't have to have a zero, that there is a tolerance of,
yes,
some,
Your Honor,
width here, right?
We do concede that. In fact, this court in Alabama Electric Co-op really set down the standard, which is as close to zero as practical. And on remand of that case, the FERC held that, and in subsequent cases, they've held that differences on the order of 2 or 3% may be permissible if they aren't in place for a long, long time.
Is there a case in which we have struck a broadband set, a band set by the FERC as being too broad?
Yes, that case. That case allowed more discrimination than 2%. I believe it was, when they finally ended up, it was 0.45 of 1%.
But our holding was not based on the breadth, but on the lack of reasoning, wasn't it?
Well, it was based on, no, Your Honor, it said that basically as a matter of law, the differences when you have no cost causation difference have to be as close to zero as possible, I believe. And that maybe it said that the FERC had not adequately explained some difference, a dissimilar circumstance that would justify the difference, but that standard has been applied consistently by the FERC ever since that decision came down.
Well, can I ask about, in Mississippi Industries, we said at the end of the opinion that rough equalization would be all right. Right?
Yes, sir.
And then on remand, in the 1987 opinion on remand of FERC, they talked about rough proportion and particularly about rotating production
facilities.
Facilities, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's certainly more than close to zero, right?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because they define
every time that something new is built, it's certainly going to go bigger than zero, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Substantially, that's larger than zero.
That's why the agreement's there.
Right.
And in Mississippi Industries, this court said the rotation produces differences.
Right.
The agreement evens them out.
Right. But and over what, time. That
No. Immediately. The agreement immediately picks up the megawatts. That was always true. The trouble was that in those days, they did it on a cost, a fixed cost basis, and they didn't take account of the fact that there were cost differences, which is the whole reason you got into trouble on the nuclear remedy. But the agreement always picked up.
Can you hold on for one second?
Yes, sir.
I'm just reading from the FERC opinion from 1987. It says, nonetheless, over time, the rotational scheme resulted in rough equalization. Not immediately, but over time.
Yeah.
Your Honor, the...
Am I reading wrong?
Yeah.
I think the words over time are in there, but the fact of the matter is the agreement was there in place. In fact, we've reviewed this in our brief supporting the FERC on the jurisdictional issue, and this court recognized, and the FERC also recognized, that the agreement picked up the differences that were caused by rotation. This rotation was put all the plants in Louisiana when natural gas was cheap, then put all the baseload plants in Arkansas when natural gas went up. So it wasn't like a unit-by-unit rotation at all.
I want to get you back, though, to the standard we're talking about here. What
yes,
is your best case saying that a bandwidth was too broad? Tell me that again.
The best case that says the bandwidth is too broad is the Arkansas Electric Co-op. We've cited a number of additional cases.
Arkansas Electric Co-op.
The Alabama Electric Co-op case.
Alabama Electric Co-op.
Yes, sir. And there are a number of FERC cases that we cited as well. That
what's your best language? Do you have a pen stat or a piece of language from Alabama that you want us to use as the standard here?
The standard is as close to zero as practical. That's a quote. As close to zero as practical. And they were doing rate of return percentage differences on a cost-adjusted basis.
But don't we learn from Mississippi Industries that one of the factors that FERC must consider is whether the equalization will have a dramatic disruption of the historical operations? Isn't that sufficient basis, given the broad discretion we give to FERC when it creates remedies? When FERC sees the situation where the remedy you're asking for would cause a dramatic disruption of the historical operations, isn't that sufficient reason, a basis for them to craft a remedy that we must defer to?
Your Honor, the Mississippi Industries case, if you read the language carefully, it says that in choosing among remedies that would correct undue discrimination. So you got to first have two remedies that would correct undue discrimination. And then in choosing among them, you may take into consideration the remedy that won't disrupt the state expectations. Now, that got muddied up a little bit because Judge Bork dissented from the historic state expectations as being a factor, and the court wound up accepting Judge Bork's dissent and sending the case back to the FERC for a more reasoned explanation of the rough equalization standard. And in responding to Judge Garland on rough equalization, the FERC in the System Energy Resources case defined rough equalization. It said approximate.
It said approximate, and it said that the rotational method was acceptable. And that certainly created more. You're saying it didn't?
No, Your Honor, it couldn't have. They haven't had rotation since 1986.
Right. I'm talking about the description in 1987.
Your Honor, I admit that there was a phrase in there about rotation of generating units, which all went back to the debate that happened before Judge Liebman as to whether the system agreement was or was not capable of fully equalizing costs. And the history was that the rotation in combination with the system agreement produced a rough equalization of costs. The FERC in the System Energy Resources case ruled that it had to have a remedy that would achieve at least an approximate equalization of costs. So if the rotation throws you off, well, then you need to have a remedy that achieves the rough equalization. And since we haven't had rotation for many, many years, it's pretty necessary to have some kind of an equalization agreement in place. But the equalization agreement in the energy system has been there since 1951. And every time a unit went into service, it was picked up in the equalization agreement on an equalize every kilowatt in the system among the company's basis. And the court recognized in Mississippi Industries that that wasn't good enough when the nuclear plants cost more per kilowatt. What they said about rotation was that the coal units would come in at a higher cost but a lower fuel cost. The gas units would come in at a lower cost and a higher fuel cost, and it worked out, the rotation in combination with the agreement. I think System Energy says that the combination of rotation and the system agreement will produce a rough equalization of costs. It doesn't say rotation alone, and they've never depended on rotation alone. And there's a good history of that in our brief supporting the respondent on the jurisdictional issue. And there's plenty of quotes from Mississippi Industries that point that out.
The same horse too awfully much, and if it's dead, I'd get off of it. But I'm not finding in Alabama Electric Corp the quotation as close to zero as practical. I West searched. You're talking about Alabama Electric 353F second 905?
I'm talking about Alabama Electric Cooperative, Your Honor.
Alabama Electric Cooperative. Is that 353F second at 905?
It's a 1982 case. I can take a look at my brief.
Well, I'm looking at an earlier version. I'm sorry. You're in a different case than I am.
Yes, Your Honor. It's
the one that's cited in the brief appears to be an earlier case than that.
Well, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure which parties are which here sometimes. But
well, I've got, there's a brief for a petitioner of the Louisiana
Public. Give me the citation of the one you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor. It's Alabama Electric Cooperative versus FERC 684, Fed Second 20. Although absolute equivalence in the overall rates of return yielded on revenues from customers or customer groups under a specific rate scheme may not be achievable in every case, it remains the standard. Any return disparity created by a rate scheme must therefore be as close to zero as circumstances permit.
Okay.
And that language, as circumstances permit, one of the circumstances is the disruption that would be caused by a particular remedy. Wouldn't you agree?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't. If that can be the standard, then you can't correct discrimination. If mitigating cost shifts, which is inherent in any rate remedy for discrimination, in every case, if that can be the stand, if that can go into what is undue discrimination, then the FERC can do anything it wants.
Now, that you gave us a non sequitur there. To say if that can go into it, it can do anything it wants, cannot be a possibly true statement.
Well, Your Honor,
it could go into it to some degree without conceivably breaching all walls of limitation.
Well, Your Honor, if you think about it, the greater the cost shift, in other words, the greater the discrimination, the more enormous it is, if that's a factor, the easier it is not to remedy it. So it's
far different from saying there are no limitations.
Well, maybe I went too far. Look, I agree with that.
Hyperbole is the stuff of advocates, but if we let you get by with that one, you could do anything you want to, according to your reasoning. Then,
well, I do think there would be. I do think.
I do want you to tell us, though. You have to admit that FERC cannot achieve zero, and that we permit FERC to not achieve zero.
Well, you have
what is the standard which we are to apply in reviewing FERC's variance from zero, which is what we're really reviewing?
Okay, this is what we say on this. Number one, we are not asking for zero. Mm-hmm. We're asking for something.
We started with that assumption. Now get past that and come to the standard of review that we're to apply.
We're asking for an equalization consistent with all the precedents, which the FERC just blew off.
What you're asking for, what standard are we supposed to apply to FERC's decision?
A few percentage
use
points.
A particular bandwidth.
A few percentage points.
Standard of review would be something like discretion. It would be something like the standard of review, the term we use lots of times as to what we're reviewing. Now, what is our standard of review here?
I think the standard of review is it consistent with law? That's one aspect of it, and is it rational? And for the FERC to say on page 53 of their brief that there are no dissimilar circumstances, and therefore wide disparities in costs, as a matter of course, it follows they're unduly discriminatory. Wide disparities in costs, as a matter of course, they're unduly discriminatory, and yet they have found and said that these differences are enormous, massive, and of amounts that would produce rate shock. You cannot reconcile those two positions. So it's irrational and it's inconsistent.
You've got us far more than answered our questions, and you're back into arguing, and your time has long since up. So
Okay, Your Honor. Well,
thank you, counsel, and we'll hear from the next oralist.
I apologize if I...
It's our fault that you're over time.
Okay.
The late Spotswood Robinson said that the lights only control the bar and only God can control the bench. Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Cochran, and I'm arguing today on behalf of the Arkansas and the Mississippi Public Service Commissions. I thought long and hard as I was preparing this oral argument, what point, if you only take one point away from what I say to you today, what that point would be. And I concluded that the point is this. The inflexible symmetrical bandwidth remedy imposed by the FERC in this case is unduly discriminatory and violates the FERC's own and this court's precedent. In the Grand Gulf litigation that led to Mississippi Industries that you've already heard about to a certain extent, a proposal was made that would have allowed Mississippi ratepayers to escape 10 years of the high front-end costs of the Grand Gulf nuclear unit and then enjoy the benefits of that unit in later years when it was less expensive. Judge Liebman, Judge Head, and the FERC all rejected this result as unduly discriminatory. This court in Mississippi Industries v. FERC affirmed the FERC on that point, and that would be found in the section on participation unit proposal, which was not encompassed in the remand that adopted Judge Bork's opinion. In this case, the FERC has imposed an even more draconian remedy, which would allow ratepayers in primarily Louisiana and Texas to escape not 10 years of high front-end cost depreciation, but 123 years of combined depreciation of our now low-cost nuclear and coal units. Now, in the face of this deviation from the court's precedent and the FERC's own precedent, how does the FERC explain why what was unduly discriminatory in 1985 is not today? Well, Your Honors, the FERC doesn't explain it. It does not even address those earlier decisions. In fact, it only makes the single conclusory statement that, well, a symmetrical bandwidth is necessary to avoid conferring an undue preference on Entergy Arkansas. That statement was made in response to arguments made by Arkansas and Mississippi that if a remedy is needed, which we do not concede, that if a remedy is needed, undue discrimination would require either a bandwidth with no lower boundary or an asymmetrical flexible bandwidth. Under the asymmetrical flexible bandwidth that we proposed, no operating company would ever be more than 11% above the system average, and there would never be a deviation of more than 22% between the highest company and the lowest company. The FERC did not address whatsoever its earlier precedents, and Your Honors, this is not reasoned decision-making. The FERC did not even attempt to undertake the fact-specific analysis that the FERC itself states in its brief before this court is necessary in addressing a claim of undue discrimination. Had the FERC undertaken that analysis, it would have found that the undue discrimination would result from its remedy as it would have resulted in 1985. The Federal Power Act does not ban all discrimination. It only bans undue discrimination or preferences. In other words, parties that are similarly situated should be similarly treated. In this case, the FERC should have found that, and there was really no dispute as a matter of fact, that the Entergy Arkansas had paid this 123, years of depreciation. They should have found that the operating companies were just not similarly situated. And therefore, an asymmetrical flexible bandwidth was not necessary to avoid conferring an undue preference on Entergy Arkansas. Now, the FERC finally, in its brief on appeals, argues for the first time that, well, that it's not really a transfer of the benefits from Arkansas and Mississippi to Louisiana and Texas because Entergy Arkansas retains first call on its low-cost units. That was just brought up on appeal, Your Honor, and the court should, of course, disregard it. And I only bring it up to point out that the FERC apparently does not even understand its own remedy and how that works and its effect. It is true that under the previous system agreement, all the operating companies had first call on their low-cost units. Under the new system agreement with the bandwidth, Entergy Arkansas continues to have first call on its low-cost units until, at the end of the year, the production costs are totaled up, computed, compared to the system average. At that point, Entergy Arkansas is below the bandwidth and is expected to continue to be below the bandwidth because of its first call on its low-cost units. At that point, ratepayers in Arkansas simply ship hundreds of millions of dollars south to Louisiana and Texas. And that is when we lose the benefits and the Louisiana and Texas ratepayers get the benefits, get to escape the 123 years of high front-end costs and get the benefits that we have paid for. Your Honors, as I mentioned earlier, we do not concede that rough equalization has been disrupted, and I guess I'm addressing the first issue second, so to speak. We continue to believe that the FERC did not engage in reasoned decision-making when it disregarded the cents per kilowatt hour analyses or costs that it had used in previous cases and relied solely on a percentage deviation analysis. And I think that's been addressed adequately in our briefs, but today I would like to emphasize just one point. The FERC in its brief here states that, that's at page 33, I believe, Your Honors, that the cost deviations in the later years in this case were greater than the 31% deviations that prompted the FERC to make its Grand Gulf allocation. And Your Honors, that is just flat not the fact. The numbers that the FERC refers to are in a chart contained in opinion number 480. The information underlying that chart was developed for this case in the 21st century and was not before the court of the FERC, back in 1985. So it could not have prompted the FERC to do anything. But perhaps more importantly, the cost of the two nuclear units, the two high-cost nuclear units that disrupted rough equalization, were not fully included in the numbers represented in the chart the FERC relies on. The costs of Grand Gulf were not included at all. And only the financing costs of the Louisiana nuclear unit, Waterford 3, were included. So that demonstrates that a 31% deviation was considered apparently permissible in the halcyon days of rough equalization. And it does not go at all to show as the FERC
claim. Maybe you can give me a concise answer. What's our standard of review in reviewing FERC's decision on what the bandwidth is?
The standard of review is that the FERC has to engage in decision reason making, and although it has some discretion, it cannot abuse that discretion, Your Honor.
So it's abuse of discretion and calls for reasoned decision making. That would be the concise statement. Thank you, Counsel.
And thank you, Your Honors, unless there are any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. I guess Mr. Longstreth. I've got a scorecard here where I keep track of the players.
It's a lot more complicated than the average argument, I understand. We're kind of like a toaster coming up and down here.
More like a Punch and Judy show, I think, if anybody remembers those.
Okay, I'll stop. The first thing I wanted to say just was in response to one of the questions I think Judge Griffith raised when he was talking about the portion of the Mississippi Industries opinion that discussed historical operation of the system. I think there may have been some suggestion that that discussion, which is, I think, you know, part four on pages 1566 or so of the decision, was affected by Judge Bork's dissent. And I just wanted to point out that in connection with Judge Bork's dissent, they vacated certain portions of the opinion. They did not vacate that particular portion of the decision. They vacated earlier portions back in 3C of the opinion. So that discussion to which Judge Griffith was referring remains in full effect. With respect to the inflexible bandwidth issue, I think that's an important issue, particularly in determining what's irrational about the FERC remedy here, because what happens with FERC's remedy by having a lower bound, it means that any cost savings that Arkansas has in the system do not go to Arkansas. They almost overwhelmingly go to the system as a whole, so that if we undertake in Arkansas, if the Arkansas regulators undertake cost savings, Arkansas doesn't get the benefit of those cost savings, and it reduces the
incentive.
Isn't
that inherent in the concept of an integrated system?
No, I don't believe it is, and that was the answer. The answer is that we don't have an incentive to create those cost savings because it's integrated, but that's not the case. For example, when this agreement was before the court back, it was a 1999 case involving the extended reserve shutdown, that exact argument was made that in an integrated system, the individual companies don't have the incentive to take actions for their own benefit, and that argument was expressly rejected. I think it was pointed out that as long as you have individual operating companies with their own regulators and their own rate payers, you're going to have differing incentives even within an overall system. So I think the argument that this doesn't create an incentive because it's an integrated system is not an accurate assessment of how the system works.
I'm not sure I heard a single answer to that.
Okay.
You're saying this is not an integrated system?
No, I'm saying that there is integration in the system, but that doesn't mean that the individual companies within that system don't act on their own and have individual incentives. And that was a finding that was expressly made in another one of the system agreement cases, the extended reserve shutdown case that was before this court back in 1999.
But sort of on the other side, if you have an integrated system and you have one company that, I take it, wholly owns each of the operating companies, is that right?
That's correct. It's a holding company structure.
Doesn't the overall company have the incentive to do least cost construction? And doesn't its committee that decides where the construction is going to be have an incentive to do that?
They do have an incentive, and there is coordination between the systems, but that doesn't mean that there aren't also individual company incentives as well, and it's those individual company incentives that are removed by the fact that there is this lower bandwidth.
That's a pretty specific level of review for us to give to decide which method to approach incentive-based rate making as among several choices the Commission obviously has. I mean, you've just conceded that the integration of the system does not defeat the concept of incentives. It simply changes it as far as the balance between individual and system-wide incentives. Should we really be reviewing the Commission on that level of specificity?
I think where the Commission has reached a result here, and I understand that there's a relatively lenient standard review for Commission remedies, but I think where the Commission is...
I was having a little trouble with a couple of arguments back as to whether that was understood by petition.
Well, but I think that, you know, I mean... Even lenient standards review aren't toothless, and even lenient standards review don't allow you to reach a result or don't allow the Commission to reach a result that really creates an irrational outcome. And it's an irrational outcome to tell Arkansas that you now have a system in place where any cost savings they undertake, anything they undertake on resource allocation or anything along those lines, those have to automatically, those increase their payments. Any cost savings
Arkansas makes. You seem to be saying to give any effect to the integrated system, defeats the concept of incentives.
Judge, no.
Garland asked you, well, isn't there still an incentive based on the incentive to the integrated system?
Well, there,
and I thought I heard you concede then that, yes, there is.
Well, the overall.
Now you seem to be going back to the original position.
No, I'm sorry if that's not clear. I think the system has some incentive, but what you're doing is you're completely removing the incentive of the individual company, and that's not inherent in the integrated system.
Are you completely removing it, or only if it goes below 11%? They still have an incentive to take advantage of the 11% bandwidth.
Well, the problem is right now Entergy Arkansas is so far below the 11%. Once you're below the 11%, any additional cost savings you have only increase your payments to Louisiana. If we save money now in Arkansas, all that does is increase the amount of the check we have to write to Louisiana at the end of the year. And that's not inherent in the integrated system, because if they did not have a lower bandwidth, if they only had a higher bandwidth, then you'd be talking about the situation we had in Grand Gulf, where you had a very expensive new nuclear plant and they wanted to spread the cost of that over the system. You could have an upper bandwidth without creating this incentive. The problem is when you have the lower bandwidth, that's what creates the disincentive, because then the cost savings are passed on to others. They're not retained by the company that should be having the incentive to engage them. So you can resolve the problem
your argument,
by removing the lower bandwidth.
How much below is it now? How much?
Oh, below? It's probably 28 or 32. It's well below the 11. And so the entire payments in
so
this
your,
case.
So your view would be that any incentives, they shouldn't get credit for any incentives unless they're even further, their cost reductions even further than the ones they have now?
Well, no, what I'm saying is that they should eliminate that lower 11% bandwidth, and then if Entergy Arkansas has cost savings, those would
have to
be retained by Entergy Arkansas.
Under your theory,
they wouldn't
excuse
be
me, under your,
paid
theory,
to
under your theory, they'd have to be even greater cost savings than they have now, right?
That's correct. Any additional cost savings. And the problem, now that we're below this 11% bandwidth, that takes away almost all of our incentive to create cost savings beyond what we already have. And the cost savings that we already have, those are primarily the result of the fact that we paid high upfront capital
but
costs.
But that's where we are right now. Your argument is about behavior in the future. So you would say then that you don't get credit for any of the cost benefits you have now, only if you produce even greater cost benefits. Is that
no? Actually, what I'm saying is we don't get credit. We get a large portion of the cost benefits we have now. We have to pay to Louisiana, and over on top of that, if we have any additional cost benefits beyond that, if we decide to lower our costs so that we're not 30% below, but 35% below. Almost all of those benefits also get paid to Louisiana. They just increase the amount of the check we have to write to them at the end of the year. So what's our incentive to save money on our system? It just means we're going to have to pay more at the end. And that is, we submit, an irrational result that's not required either by the integration of the system or by the remedy. All you have to do is eliminate that lower bandwidth, and you take away that problem.
It would be the case if this were a single company as opposed to an integrated system with a holding company and separate operative companies, that they would not be permitted to discriminate among their customers. Is that fair to say?
Well, actually, I think in this case, I don't think that's the case, because in this case, if it were a single company, what you have here is primarily retail sales, and that single company would be able to, let's put it this way, that single company would be able to make the retail sales, and FERC would not have the authority to come in and try to equalize that.
Okay.
I think that's correct. The final point I would make, and I think this goes with respect to the fact there was reference to Louisiana having had to site its natural gas plants in lower cost areas. Those were decisions that benefited not only the system but also Louisiana at the time. In other words, again, this is not a situation like Grand Gulf where Louisiana says we're faced with a high cost nuclear plant that's going to be a deadweight loss to us. Those plants were sited there because gas was cheap there, and that benefited Louisiana, and Louisiana in fact got the benefits of that over a large portion of the period that we looked at during this case. Since the Grand Gulf allocation, and this was the point we made in our life of the contract argument, or anti-cherry picking argument, if you look over that entire period, and the commission agreed on that, and the administrative law judge agreed on that, over that entire period, things that evened out. Louisiana had a benefit early on. We were paying more in Arkansas and Mississippi, and then it switched around toward the end of that period. So if you look over the entire period, you've got it equaled out. What your commission is allowing them to do here, and it's in violation of what they've done in other cases, is to take the benefits early on and then try to give away the burdens later on. And when we pointed out our life in the contract cases, which do apply, not just to fixed rate contracts and not just to arm's length contracts, that's not been permitted. The commission has said in that context and in more broad contexts, California spot market cases that we cited, that you can't allow a party to do that. Take the benefits early and then turn around and try to shove off the burdens later.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Perry.
I'd like to begin, if I could, with the argument that first of all, I'd like to point out that it's not true that the commission didn't make a finding that Entergy Arkansas was continuing to receive a benefit from its low-cost generation, just not to the same degree. That's, in fact, exactly what the commission said in 480A, paragraph 106, 378. And the point is that the commission, they're continuing to receive a benefit, as is evident from the prior discussion. For example, when they made the recent bandwidth filing on May 29, 2007, Entergy Arkansas was, in fact, 28% below the system average, while Entergy Louisiana was more like 9% above the system average. They continue to receive a benefit, just not to the same extent. They don't continue to be 28% below system average, but they are still, by the time the bandwidth is applied, they're 11% below system average, whereas all of the companies other than Entergy New Orleans still continue to be above the system average.
What about their argument that there's no incentive under those circumstances to lower costs?
First of all, because it is an integrated system, the system planning is done by the Entergy System Operating Committee, not by the individual companies, and it's ultimately the operating committee that determines what system units will be purchased and what generation will be built. And Entergy Arkansas isn't benefiting from low-cost generation because it made clever decisions. It's benefiting because at the time, once the gas prices became very high and uneconomical, they shifted to nuclear and to coal generation, which they chose to build in Entergy Arkansas's area because they were next up on the rotation and they were perennially short. And so it's part of the overall rotation. It has nothing to do with particular companies having made wise decisions at any particular point. Fundamentally, what the commission found was, and you can see this with regard to the discussion of the asymmetrical remedy at 480A, paragraph 46,
yeah.
Joint appendix.
Yeah, tell me, what joint appendix page are we on?
356, Your Honor.
356?
356, Your Honor, paragraph 46. Where the commission is discussing the asymmetrical remedy, the point being that it's an undue discrimination or undue preference for any of the individual companies in the integrated system to be able to enjoy such a huge disparity in cost from the other companies. And that was the commission's finding, that there had to be a symmetrical remedy and there had to be a limit on the bottom side as well as on the top side, because it's simply not fair for Entergy Arkansas to be 28% below system average when the other companies are 9% above. It is simply too large of a disparity.
What about their argument that they paid for that difference?
Well, the commission's response to that argument, Your Honor, is in that paragraph 106 at JA 378. And the commission made several responses to that. The first one was they have enjoyed a benefit from that investment in the low-cost generation. Since 1996, they've had below-cost production costs. And they are continuing to benefit, as the commission found, because they continue to be, even with the application of the bandwidth, they continue to be 11% below system average costs. Furthermore, because of the integrated nature of the system, there's no guarantee to any individual company that they will continue to indefinitely receive all of the benefit of any of their generation. The benefits
now,
and burdens.
They're looking at a snapshot, but you inherently have to look at a snapshot. What is their incentive if they're already beating the 11%? What is their incentive for any other cost saving if they're simply going to have to write the check to the other states, as counsel argued?
The argument is, the point is, Your Honor, is that the incentive is the Entergy system as a whole. It retains the incentive to make the least cost decision for the system as a whole. The individual companies themselves really have no ability to exercise an incentive one way or the other. And this is discussed in particular in the initial decision at paragraph 44, Joint Appendix 190. And because of the integrated system planning, the ultimate decision about system planning is made by the operating committee, and the individual companies have no ability, really, to exercise an incentive one way or the other to limit costs fundamentally at the end of the day. And the operating committee obviously retains an incentive to limit costs overall, which is the point of the whole rotational system. Any given company at any time, you can't minimize costs to the system overall and at the same time make sure that each individual company also has the absolute minimum cost. And the way the system is operated is for the system overall to achieve least cost, and that provides benefits to all of the companies.
What's your answer to Louisiana's inverse argument?
The full equalization argument or the...
Well, they're saying they're not making a full, they're making it as close to zero. But their argument that you agree that there's a massive, enormous difference, that's the reason you don't, you want to set up a bandwidth that would create rate shock, but that just establishes that the bigger the difference, the less likely it is that there's going to be equalization.
In the first instance, the commission, in Mississippi Industries, it was established that rough equalization is permissible measure of discrimination on this system. And the commission, in opinion 480, at paragraph 65, Joint Appendix 281, and at paragraph 73, Joint Appendix 284, found that in this case, as in Mississippi Industries, where the same result was reached, that full equalization was just too intrusive and it was not necessary in order to restore rough equalization. That the only obligation on the commission is to address undue discrimination, and that so long as the equalization was within the boundaries of rough, then that was sufficient. And as the court found in Mississippi Industries, 808 Fed Second at 1566, the court found that it was an appropriate application of policy because the federal regulation is supposed to supplement, not supplant, state regulation. And so the commission is regulating the production costs of the companies to the extent necessary to maintain rough equalization without unduly intruding onto state regulatory interests.
That's all the definition of what rough is.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, that just says you can use rough. Question now is, what's rough?
How rough is too rough?
Well, this is the way the commission came to the definition of what constituted rough in this case. First of all, they made the determination that the system was out of rough equalization by looking at the deviations since the time of the Grand Gulf reallocation. For 14 years of that time, there were year-to-year variations, there was no long-term bias, and the costs, even though they varied from positive to minus, tended to be close to the system average for those 14 years. And you can find this at 480, paragraph 16, at Joint Appendix 265, paragraph 141, Joint Appendix 305, and also in the initial decision, paragraph 32, 186. So the commission found that the current disparities starting in 2000 were far more than it had been for the last 14 years, that they were comparable to the disparities in 1983 to 1985 when the Grand Gulf was reallocated. And by the way, I should point out, I've never heard this argument that the Grand Gulf costs were not included in the 1983 to 1985 costs before. Nobody has ever raised that. I have never heard that argument. I do not know that to be the case.
I'm willing to believe I've forgotten one of the arguments out of these briefs by this time, however, counsel.
In addition to the fact that it was comparable to the 1983-85 disparities, the commission also found that these large disparities were likely to continue into the future. And you can also find this discussion at 488 paragraph.
I'm asking to answer the Louisiana argument, which is the opposite. They agree there's big disparities. They want to know why they're not corrected.
But that goes back to the issue of rough equalization, though, Your Honor.
That's the one he's asking.
That's the one I was asking about.
Well, what I'm saying is how the commission defined rough equalization in this case is it went back and looked at the period of 14 years where there were year-to-year variations, where they were close to system average, where there was no long-term bias, and they regarded that as being an exemplar of what the numerical values are when the system is in rough equalization. And so they looked at that 14-year period, and they picked the largest disparity existing during that 14-year period and defined that as being the limits of rough equalization.
Now, is that, where's the best place to see that?
This is, you can start at 480, paragraphs 143 to 44.
Give me the JA page.
Joint appendix at 306.
Say again?
At Joint Appendix at 306, Your Honor,
36.
Paragraphs 143 to 144. And there the commission discusses this chart in the Entergy Facts and History, and it says that deviations up to 22% occurred during this period of rough equalization. And so based on this historical data, we determined that a bandwidth of plus or minus 11% is reasonable under these circumstances. And this is after having examined those 14 years and determined that they had characteristics of equalization. Again, year-to-year variations, no long-term bias, and the fact that they were, even though they intended to go back and forth from positive to negative, they tended to be close to system average. And so that's...
2 minutes ago, I had that chart in front of me. I have now turned away from it, and I don't remember what page it was on.
And Your Honor, it's at it's paragraphs 30 and 31, Joint Appendix 269 to 70 is the chart that the commission was analyzing.
Thank you.
So that was the basis for the commission's determination that this is the boundaries of rough equalization in this case, because during this 14-year period where the commission determined that the ALJ determined that the system was in rough equalization, this was the largest deviation that occurred during that time, and that's how the commission selected that as the boundary for rough equalization in this case. As the commission pointed out, before then, there had been approval of the concept of rough equalization, but there had never been a point where the commission was called upon to give it a numerical value. And
what
so,
what do you say about their citation of the Alabama Electric Co-op case?
Well, in the first place, Judge Santel is correct. If you look at page 26 of that case, the court did find that FERC erred in refusing to consider the undue discrimination argument and remanded it for consideration to the commission. And furthermore, at 480, paragraph 72, Joint Appendix 284, the commission addressed those cases, the Alabama case as well as the other cases that were cited by the Louisiana Commission. It made the point that they were rate of return cases and price squeeze cases that were based on the particular facts presented there, and that undue discrimination is essentially a factual inquiry, and in the context of the Entergy system, those cases are an apposite, and you have to look at what, given the Entergy facts and the existence of rough equalization and the fact that it was never the intent to equalize all costs on the system, then what are the limits of undue discrimination? So you have to look at the facts on this system, the history of this system, and the way it operated in order to determine what constitutes rough equalization, which is the definition of undue discrimination.
Give me that last JA reference again.
That last JA reference is 480 paragraph.
Start with the JA.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's 284, Your Honor.
284, okay.
Paragraph.
That's the way I'm going to find it easiest, is if you give me the JA, but that's the way it comes to us.
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I need to write my notes in reverse orders so that it comes out first. But that's where the commission is discussing. They don't actually cite to the Alabama case, but they're responding to that case as well as the other cases that the Louisiana Commission cited for that proposition.
Ms. Perry, help me think. think this through a little bit. As I understand it, it is FERC's position that an effort, a remedy that seeks to avoid a massive disruption in cost allocation is that's a sufficient basis for choosing one remedy over another. Is that right? Is that FERC's argument? That if FERC is presented with two remedies, and one of them avoids what FERC considers to be a massive disruption in cost allocation, that would be sufficient basis for choosing that remedy over the alternative?
I don't believe that I would say that that's true, Your Honor. I think in this case what the Commission found was consistent with Mississippi Industries that the full equalization remedy, which would cause the largest cost shifts, obviously, was too intrusive and not necessary, not just because of the size of the cost shifts, but also because of the intrusion on state jurisdiction and the fact that it's inconsistent with the history of the operation of the
energy. As I understand what the FERC opinion, there were really two linchpins of the argument. One is that to choose something less than 11% would cause this massive disruption. And the second was that a period of rough equalization had been achieved after Mississippi Industries, and FERC looked to that for a benchmark, is that right, to determine what an adequate remedy would be?
Is that right? Your Honor. Absolutely,
but,
Your Honor.
But it seems to me that FERC was animated primarily by a concern of massive disruption of cost if it had gone below 11%. Is that not right?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the Commission was concerned about the magnitude of cost shifts between the companies, but it wasn't, I mean, the cost shifts alone in the abstract don't really drive the decision.
What drives the decision then?
Well, what drives the decision is that rough equalization is historically...
And I understand that. You can't get to zero. I know that, but how do you get to 11?
You get to 11, Your Honor, and this is the point. This is when the Commission was rejecting the ALJ's bandwidth remedy, which was more narrow than that. The Commission was pointing out that the more narrow bandwidth is not, in fact, tied to the evidence in the record, and it's not representative of those deviations that are in that chart for the 14 years from 1986 to 1989. And this is, you can see this at the Joint Appendix at 488, at Joint Appendix at 354, and in Opinion 480, 303 to 304, where the Commission is talking about the fact that in looking at those 14 years, the plus or minus 11% is what is based on the historical operation of the Entergy system, and a smaller bandwidth than that is not consistent with that evidence.
But how do we know that's rough equalization? How do we determine what rough equalization is without just giving the whole game away to FERC to decide what it means in any situation? How do we know this 13 or 14 year period after Mississippi Industries, how do we know that was rough equalization? The ALJ said it was, but I don't recall anything in the ALJ's opinion to help us understand why that is rough equalization.
It's the analysis that the Commission did of what happened during that time period, Your Honor. If you look at Opinion 480 at Joint Appendix 265 and 305, and in the initial decision at Joint Appendix 186, 189, you'll see there that they go through an analysis where they describe the fact that looking at the 14 years, there was a year-to-year variation, there was no long-term bias, the pendulum swung from positive to negative for the various companies, there were no 5 to 10 year-long large deviations in the same direction, which is what is happening now, and during that time period, the companies tended to be close to system average for many of the years, and that pattern had dramatically changed now, but in looking at the characteristics of that pattern, that's what the Commission viewed as being characteristics of rough equalization. Even though there are positives and negatives, they switch between the companies, they tend towards the system average, there's no long-term bias in favor of one company or another, and that's why the Commission viewed that 14-year period as being appropriately representative of rough equalization.
What you're telling us is that the phrases rough equalization and undue discrimination are really quite vague, and you're asking us to defer to FERC on a case-by-case situation, because I haven't heard any standard yet by which we can make a determination of our own. don't have a good sense. If someone were to ask me what is rough equalization, I'm not certain I know what the standard is based on the briefs or the argument.
Well, Your Honor, there had never been a numerical figure attached to rough equalization, and the descriptions of rough equalization in the past had been, you know, essentially like in 292, which was affirmed in the city of New Orleans. It's just, you know, each operating utility should share in the overall capacity cost of the system in rough proportions to the benefit it receives. And here the commission was called upon to give a numerical.
Back to a question I asked another one of counsel earlier. Is there a case in which we have said that the number by itself defining the variation was too great to be rough equalization?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the rough equalization has never been quantified. This is the first case where because in the Grand Gulf decisions, they fully equalized the nuclear investment costs in order to bring the rest of this system back into rough equalization, and there was no argument in that case that the rest of the system wasn't in rough equalization, so there was no definition given to that term at the time. This is the first time the commission was presented with the necessity of putting a number on rough equalization, and it did that by looking at the historical operations of the Entergy system and during a time period when it had what the commission considered to be characteristics of rough equalization, again, the switching back and forth, the no long-term bias against any company, the tendency towards the system average, and over that time period picked the largest disparity that occurred under those circumstances and chose that as the determination of what the outer limits of rough equalization is. So in other words, there was substantial evidence to support the commission's determination of what the appropriate boundaries would be for a rough equalization bandwidth in this case.
If you're defining rough equalization historically.
That's right, Your Honor.
Taking out those years which you think they were not rough equalization.
That's right, Your Honor.
But in doing that, part of your argument was that the swings generally evened out over time, right? Sometimes up, sometimes down.
That's right, Your Honor.
So an individual state wouldn't necessarily be up or down in any particular time, right?
Over time. That's right, Your Honor.
But the prediction now is that this is going to be stable for quite some time, right?
It's going to be that was the purpose of the bandwidth, Your Honor, because it's going to be stable to the detriment of Entergy Louisiana for a considerable period of time, which is
right. If that's the case, if historically it was rough equalization because sometimes Louisiana would be low and sometimes it would be high, but now we know that you expect in the future that not to be the case. Why is that still rough equalization?
It isn't rough equalization anymore, Your Honor. The commission found.
No, but why isn't it, once you've added your 11% bandwidth, why is that rough equalization if you expect the states to stay on either side of the band for the foreseeable future?
It is rough equalization in the sense that there has been this historic period of people are advantaged or disadvantaged for a given period of time, and then it switches, but it hasn't ever been of the magnitude of the deviations that existed at this time. And
so let me see if I can put the point a little more sharply. Okay, your argument is that historically it's been no more than 11% in either direction, and that was rough equalization. And during that period, by the way, people went up and down. Sometimes they were within the lower 11%, sometimes they were within the upper 11%, right? And now, so you're saying, okay, so we're going to put on an 11% on either side. But it seems to me that the distinction here is that over the entire period you were talking about, you said states went up and down. Now you expect states not to go up and down. That is, I can see an argument for rough equalization if sometimes you're 11% below and sometimes you're 11% above. But why is that rough equalization if your prediction into the future is the ones who are 11% below are going to stay 11% below and the ones who are 11% above are going to stay 11% above?
Your Honor, it isn't the case. I didn't mean to suggest that it's the case that they switched from positive to negative in any given year, even during the period of rough equalization. I mean, if you look at the chart.
I'm not asking what you thought. I'm asking what the FERC thought. And if I look at JA 305, it says, these swings have generally evened out over time, with certain operating companies enjoying lower production costs in some years and higher costs in other years. Now, isn't it the expectation that won't continue?
What the commission was trying to do, Your Honor, because if you consider the fact that up until 1994 to 95, as the commission says in that paragraph, that Entergy Louisiana actually had costs that were below system average. I mean, for periods of years, there are periods where it is on one side or the other.
But you're not really coming to grips with the question, are you? If one of the factors that made it rough equalization was the changing position of the companies, and they're not going to be changing anymore, or not anticipated to be, won't that, the states, won't that affect the validity of the rough equalization calculation?
And I'm saying no, Your Honor, because the historical basis that the commission was using, for example, Entergy Louisiana was below system average costs for, 8 or 9 years of that period. And it's not that there's a period where they stay on one side of the equation so much as it's the magnitude of the disparity that was the issue. And what the commission was trying to do was to address the magnitude of the detriment to Entergy Louisiana so that it became more like the historical period where they tended more towards system average and there wasn't such a large disparity between the companies. I mean, now it's, with...
So we should ignore the sentence in paragraph 141 to the effect that the pendulum of production cost disparities has swung back and forth from negative to positive among the operating companies?
No, Your Honor, but when you look at the evidence that the commission was looking at, you'll see it didn't swing back and forth every year. It swung back and forth.
We're looking at what the commission reasoned, and they followed the sentence I just read with the expression, these swings have generally evened out over time, with certain operating companies enjoying lower production costs in some years and higher costs in other years.
That's right, Your Honor, but the commission goes on to point out, prior to 1994-95, which means from 1986 to 1994-95, Entergy Louisiana was below average. And after that time, Entergy Arkansas is then below average. But so what the commission is saying is, what they mean by the pendulum is expressed by that sentence, which is from the period 1986 to 1994-95, Entergy Louisiana was on the same side of the equation. But the pendulum still swung back. And then Entergy Arkansas was on that side for a period of years. It didn't have to change year to year, is my point. It's the magnitude that was the problem. It needed to communicate the magnitude of the disparity between the companies. And you can see this in 480 in that paragraph in 305 and also paragraph 16 at Joint Appendix 265, where the commission talks about the fact that there were variations, but over the history, they're looking at this historical period where the pendulum swings weren't a matter of year to year, but were a matter of more 8 or 9 years to 8 or 9 years. It didn't have to swing back and forth every year in order for there to be rough equalization. And this is, again, a function of the way the system works.
Are you saying that if for the next 9 years it stays the way it is, then at some point you'll have to reconsider it again, even if the costs are within the bandwidth, because some states are always above and some states are always below?
Certainly, Your Honor. Louisiana could bring another complaint, and then the issue of whether the system is still in rough equalization would be addressed at that time. What the commission was trying to do was to correct what it saw as the large disparities that existed at the time and were likely to continue into the near future. You have to remember there's also the issue of the SSRP, the resource acquisition plan that Entergy was about to engage in, is now engaging in, that was supposed to bring new resources into the system and was supposed to aid in bringing rough equalization back, because it had been the suspension of acquiring new capacity, and that was supposed to help. So we'll have to see whether that actually...
Well, I thought you didn't think that was going to help enough.
Not in the near future, Your Honor, was the point. Because the argument that was being made was this new acquisition plan, there wasn't any need for remedy here because this new acquisition plan was going to solve the problem of it being out of rough equalization. And the commission's finding was, even if it does, it's not going to do it in the short term, and we have to have a remedy now. Because the projections are through 2005, even until 2009, that there, these large disparities were going to continue.
All right. Seeing no further question and hearing none from Utah, your time is a bit past, and we will hear from the intervener.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Wayne Anderson, representing the intervener Entergy Operating Companies and their affiliated service company, which, if I'm called on to do, I will refer to collectively as Entergy, if that pleases the court. Mm-hmm. Originally, I thought this was going to be a pretty dull topic, but most of my 7 minutes...
When did you get over that?
I got over it about 20 minutes ago when I started hearing questions that bore directly on what I thought I would be addressing. Everyone always believes that what they have to say is the most important thing, and so I may be deceiving myself, but I would like to explain exactly what you said, Judge Sentell, about how rough is too rough. This is the first case in which the FERC has had to grapple with that issue, and I think it's very important. There's no question but that in 234 and 234A and its progeny, including Mississippi Industries, in 292 and 292A, and in the city of New Orleans, everyone settled upon the fact that, notwithstanding the arguments of the Louisiana Commission, precise equalization would not be required. It was called full production cost equalization, but it's precise equalization, getting the disparities down to zero. That wasn't going to be the goal, and the reason given universally, including by this court in Mississippi Industries, was that precise equalization would represent a dramatic disruption of the system's historical operations and of the state's settled interests and expectations. Now, to assess how rough is too rough, the FERC in this case looked at what I call the Grand Gulf fix. It was that overall resolution of the 1982 system agreement, which did not, by the way, contrary to comments earlier, it did not immediately cause all costs to come back in balance. In fact, it never worked that way, and it would take forever for that to happen. But the court and the FERC fixed the 1982 agreement, and it fixed the Grand Gulf allocation in such a way as to produce rough equalization, and everybody said, go forth, my son, and sin no more. After 1985, everything's going to be roughly equal. The FERC looked at the period pre-1986, the 3 years before 86, and found that the average annual deviation was at least 31% a year. It looked at the 3 years after 1999, and it noticed that in those, two of them were calendar years, one was 12 months ended August 2002. It noticed that the annual deviation was in excess of 33% each year. But when it looked at the post-Grand Gulf fix period, it noticed that the average annual deviation for those 14 years, 1986 to 1999, was about just under 14.5% per year, and that the maximum deviation was 22%. But the remedy that the FERC imposed doesn't operate the same way those 14 years operated, and that's something that apparently is not readily seen by everyone. The remedy of plus or minus 11% is going to cause all of the high-cost companies to be less than 3.5% above system average. It's really simple to understand. If you imagine my arm, and I'll hold it high so Judge Griffith can see it. If you imagine my arm as the Utah horizon, not everyone can be below the system average. If that was so, the system average would have gone down. Not everyone can be above it.
Well, in Lake Wobegon, you can't. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, but in this case, we have five operating companies, and they each have a specific contribution to the overall system. Entergy Arkansas is approximately 23% of the overall system. And it's going to be driven from 28 or so percent below to 11% below by making what turned out to be a $252 million payment. Unlike 1986 through 1999, where somebody was below and somebody was above, there's actually going to be a payment made, and that payment is going to have the effect of suppressing or dampening or reducing the high-cost companies that are above system average. And because we know that Entergy Arkansas is exactly 23%, and because we know it's going to be at 89%, we know as a mathematical certainty that the average of the other four companies will be less than 3.5% above system average. That's the only way the math works out. And so what do we know from that? We know that the average disparity produced by the plus or minus 11% is really going to be less than 14.5% each year, which is the 14-year experience that the FERC looked at. And we really know that if there were another company that was exactly 23% of the system, like Arkansas is, and it were exactly 11% above, we'd know that the other three companies were right at system average. But that doesn't happen. All that we know for certain is until such time as, and Judge Garland, you talked about, well, can these eggs be scrambled in the future? Will there be disparities going one way or another way? Yes, there will be. I mean, there are plans to build coal units. The company has made arrangements to queue up, get in line, to build some nuclear units. Those units will be built. They'll be allocated or assigned to people. Lots of things can happen. Entergy New Orleans in the late 90s was 27% above system average. Currently, it's down at system average. It's a very small company, so it can move rapidly. But the point is that none of this is cast in stone. It doesn't move very quickly, because you don't add units very quickly. But there will be movement in the future. But what we know right now is that Arkansas will be making very large payments, and those payments will crush the other companies' high costs above system average down so that they're less than 3.5% above system average. Now, if I were assessing how rough is too rough, I might, in fact, I have concluded that that's close enough. But the real lesson from this is look at the plus or minus 5% proposed by the Louisiana Commission. Right now, the high-cost companies are going to be 3.5% or less from system average. And if you go to plus or minus 5%, the same math will tell you that with 23% of the system, moving Arkansas from 89% up to 95%, that is, moving it up, having it make that, instead of a $252 million payment, a much bigger payment, that will push every high-cost company so that it is now less than 2% above system average. And to my way of thinking, 1.5% above system average is the functional equivalent of precise equalization, and neither this court nor the FERC has required that anyone go there. This remedy, plus or minus 11%, really does replicate the post-Grand Gulf fix results.
How much, to ask you the same question I was asking before and that you started to help answer, how much of FERC's discussion, though, of the historical period after Grand Gulf relied on the fact that they went up and down, that there was a pendulum swinging during this period? Maybe I'm misrecollecting, but I thought I recollected FERC as to say that they did not expect that pendulum to continue into the future, at least into the foreseeable future. Am I wrong about either of those?
And of course, I can't speak for the FERC.
Well, I'm asking you to speak by referring to what the FERC said, not by imagining you were FERC.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Because you don't want to be FERC.
My appreciation of what the FERC did was it concluded that there were swings from time to time, and there certainly was discussion in the case and in the order about the fact that, and you can look at, well, it's very difficult to look at Joint Appendix 511. When I looked at it this morning, I discovered that someone had cleverly placed a sticky note right over the salient features of it. But you can at least discern what was happening to Entergy Arkansas during that time, and you can see that post the Grand Gulf fix, Entergy Arkansas had results that were above system average for 1986 through 1993, 8 years by my count. And then things turned around, and by 2000 and 2001, and the test year ended August 2002, Entergy Arkansas was significantly below average. So clearly the FERC recognized that changes of that type would be possible.
Now, what is the best shot at what FERC thinks is going to be the future so far as the same sort of deviation, variation, and crossing the line?
My best shot, and I apologize that I don't have the joint appendix right at my fingertips. My best shot is that the FERC observed that they were hopeful that the resource planning and the rotational assignment over time would address this problem, but that as an insurance policy, they were going to impose the plus or minus 11%. And so I suspect that they were hopeful that we'd be right in what we were doing, but that if we weren't, they would backstop it. And my only point here today about the remedy is...
I thought they put it sort of the other way. They didn't expect it to work, but they'd be happy if it did.
Well,
rather than they expected it to work, and this was a backstop. Am I wrong?
I thought that they said they hoped it would work, but they viewed it as an insurance policy. And backstop, whatever else. I recall the insurance policy language because I thought, oh, my friends in Arkansas are going to think that's a pretty expensive policy. But on the other hand, the final point I wanted to make, and I'll be very brief if I can just make this one point, the salient feature of the plus or minus 5% is that given the math, that remedy, had the FERC imposed it, would have meant that everyone would have been crushed, so all the high-cost companies, so close to system average that you would have been at precise equalization. And I think of it this way.
You actually made that point, and your time is... we've kept you on your feet past your red light.
I have one more question.
All right, Garland has another question.
As the representative of the overall company, can you say something about what kind of incentives the operating companies will no longer have or will have as compared to incentives for lower costs that that Energy can impose?
Sure. I heard the question earlier, and what immediately came to my mind was the tax situation, the federal income tax situation in the 60s, where people would pay as an income tax perhaps 75 or 80% of their income. They still had an incentive to earn money, however. And although counsel for AEEC was correct in the sense that the incentive has been dampened, if there's $100 of benefits created, Arkansas still keeps its share of the benefits. It still keeps 23%. It might have to pay a 77% tax, but it still gets to keep a portion of it, and it's the beneficiary of good things that happen in other companies. When they reduce costs, Arkansas, likewise, is the beneficiary because the system average goes down, and when the system average goes down, Arkansas is less far from the system average, and its payment goes down by
20%. The sinking tide lowers all boats.
Yes, that's true.
Does Energy have the ability to force cost reductions, or is that up to, other than construction issues, or is that up to individual companies?
I apologize. Force cost reduction in what respect?
Well, I'm not sure, because nobody is being specific about what kind of cost reductions we're talking about.
But let me
if you can imagine yourself over there in the discussion on not having an incentive to reduce costs, whatever costs they were talking about, can Energy impose some kind of requirements that lead to those costs being reduced?
Ostensibly, it could. What it could do is the system as a system could say, we've decided that we want 500,000 people on bicycles, stationary bicycles, to make electricity, and it's going to cost $1 billion, and we're going to assign it to one of these companies and tell the company, go get it approved. And the company gets it approved, and then they export, in the case of Arkansas, 77% of that cost, and then everybody comes up here and says, wait a while, that was totally imprudent, it was a big waste of money, and there'll be a big bunch of litigation about it, as there is about everything related to the system agreement. But the point is, the company as a system makes decisions most of the time with respect to, certainly in the case of the nuclear and coal units, it makes decisions. This is the direction we want to go. We're going to assign one of the units to one company, one of the units to another company, move them into rates, and then the FERC steps in and says, no. That rough is too rough, and we're going to reassign it or reallocate it. And I suspect that approach will continue, Judge Garland. Is that responsive? I don't know if I...
It's responsive, but I think there's vagueness with respect to what kind of cost reductions we're talking about in the first place. If you're talking about riding on the bicycles, I take it that's a construction decision, like a construction decision of a new energy source. Are there other... and I understand that the umbrella company has some authority in that respect. Are there other kind of costs that they're talking about here, or are those the only kind of costs we're talking
about? No, I
think
by and large what everyone's... What I surmise everyone's talking about are cost reductions from building a plant today that uses a non-natural gas fuel as a fuel source.
Operational decisions after construction would be fairly inconsequential as far as the system-wide or the systemic savings.
Assuming that the plant operates correctly. I mean, if there was some massive destruction of the plant through bad operation, that would be the exception. But the bulk of the costs are going to be upfront, very high capital costs, and then after 10 or 15 years of depreciation, the low-cost fuel will begin to offset what remains of the high capital costs, and then you'll see savings.
Assuming that fuel is still low cost that many years later.
That's true, although in the case of coal, the United States itself has a vast supply of coal, but we can't tell what the EPA may do, and I'm not griping about that, I'm just saying we can't tell. None of us can really tell where that's going.
I would suppose if anyone had 100% hold on predicting energy prices, we wouldn't have them in the courtroom. They'd be at the market, commodities market somewhere.
That's a good way of saying Anderson doesn't know.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Did he have any time left?
No, he did not. The only one that had time was...
Beg your pardon?
The only person that had time was Ms.
The only person who had time left was Ms. Cochran. I think it might be helpful, however, if we gave you a back about 2 minutes. So let's... Ms. Cochran had more time than you. I mean, she has more left than you, and I want to give you 2 minutes if that's agreeable with my colleagues. If it's not, I'll do it anyway. So go ahead.
I would like to...
Well, I'm going to give him 2.5.
Okay.
Judge Garland, the Siri decision is page 61618 in the Siri decision 292. It's rotation plus the 1951 and 1973 agreements achieved rough equalization. Uh-huh. Is the quote that I was mentioning earlier. Secondly, for Judge Griffith, the Bork dissent, which was adopted by this court, does say. On page 1569.
Give me that full citation so I can get back to the right case.
The which one?
The full citation to what you're citing.
The
right?
Siri decision, opinion 292, it's at page...
No, the Bork, no, the adoption of the Bork dissent. I'm not sure what you understand, what to understand by the language this court adopted the Bork dissent.
What I understand by the adoption of the Bork decision was the court said for the reasons stated by Judge Bork.
Now, where did the court say this? That's what I'm trying to ask you. Give
me
that.
It was in a rehearing decision, and it was on consideration of rehearing.
822F second 1104, but that opinion specifically says which pages of the panel opinion were dropped, right?
Were dropped, that's
and
right.
Left the remaining pages.
That's right. So I'm not sure exactly how it comes out, but Judge Bork definitely says that historic disruption of historic operations of the system is not a justification because historically the system's costs were equalized. That's on page 1569. When the case went back to the FERC, they made it very clear you got to have approximate equalization first, and then you can choose not to go to full production cost equalization, but you have to have approximate equalization. With regard to the point about going back to the past, I'd like to point out this. The FERC established a standard in 86. It did not have a systematic mechanism to enforce it. So what happened happened.
You're now in the additional half minute that Judge Garland gave you. Excuse me, go ahead.
So what happened happened. And it was during a period of non-enforcement when the costs weren't even reported that this 22% happened. The ALJ only said that rough production cost equalization generally was maintained. He made a finding that 5 to 7.5 was rough production cost equalization. And finally, with regard to this mathematical certainty that Council for Energy mentioned, that assumes that there are 3 or 4 production companies that receive payments. In the record, that wasn't what was happening.
You're now
there was only
the half minute you were given by Judge Garland. So
I'm over my time.
Your time's up and used.
It's not a mathematical
certainty. The remaining time of Ms. Cochran.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. She has. Pardon? Has how much?
5 minutes and a half.
5 minutes and a half left. Okay. Give her 6. It's easier to keep up with.
I doubt I'll take them. I seem to be more concise than some of our counsel who have argued
appreciate
today.
It. Go ahead.
You're welcome. I would like to address the perverse incentives argument that has been discussed. And first, I have to say I was bemused by counsel for the FERC's assertion that it was impossible for an individual operating company to make a cost decision, and that ultimately the system operating committee makes all of the decisions, because I'm looking at page 7 of the FERC's respondents brief. At the bottom of the page, the paragraph beginning, "The structure of the energy system has significant implications for state regulation of generation facilities and retail rates. Because capacity acquisitions are allocated to individual operating companies, the retail regulator of that company approves the acquisition resource, giving the retail regulator control over the cost of the new generation and related choices." And that is the point that the argument this morning so far has missed, the role of the retail regulator as well as other state agencies in influencing energy's production costs that lead to the perverse incentives. And, Your Honors, this is not an inconsequential problem. Entergy Arkansas has issued its notice that it will withdraw from the system agreement in effective 2013 as a result of this opinion. As I said, it's not simply, and you talked earlier about.
So how does that, is it up to us to decide whether that withdrawal is overall a good thing or a bad thing? Isn't that up to FERC to make that decision?
Your Honor, I would suggest that, yes, the FERC does have discretion in its remedies, but they, number one, it should be reasoned, and we do not believe the FERC was, as I said earlier, engaged in reasoned decision-making and rejecting the asymmetrical bandwidth in particular. And number two, they can't abuse that discretion. And a remedy that has the promise of raising system costs overall is not rational, and I would suggest it's an abuse of discretion. And
with respect to what you just said, do you have a way out? Does Arkansas have a way out by just stepping out of the system?
Well, Your Honor,
Is that what you just said?
The LPSC has already filed a case at the FERC, which was dismissed, but only for a few years, challenging, number one, our ability to withdraw, and number two, asserting that
maybe an idle threat. Then.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, Your Honor. It might be.
Well, it's either an idle threat, in which case it doesn't play into the argument, or it's a threat you can make good on, in which case that's a solution for Arkansas's problem.
It's a solution after 8 years and hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's a solution that partly, would dismantle, an operating company system that has, for the most part, operated economically and provided benefits for decades. And we don't believe that that is a good result for anyone, Your Honor. But if I could get back, you had talked about generation decisions being the major driver, but there are other decisions that affect the production costs as well. For example, if we have, I think, pending a docket on integrated resource planning, which would lower our utilities costs as a result, in part, of reducing demand. And that is a very frustrating exercise when it comes to Entergy Arkansas, because the end result is, although we do get to keep a small portion of the benefits, the main result is we have to send a larger check down south. Another point is that it is not just the retail regulators that make these decisions. For example, property taxes on utility plant are set by state legislators. And if the Arkansas legislature were to decide to raise the property taxes, we could get 100% of the benefits of the taxes for only 23% of the cost. Now, Mr. Anderson said we would also benefit in Arkansas if other companies make decisions that lower system costs. Well, that's true, but the problem is they have very little incentive to make those decisions.
Was there a period when Arkansas's costs were higher?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
And by how much higher?
I don't have the exhibit right in front of me. I could get it if you want me to. I really can't give you a number.
So didn't they get the benefit of the system during that period?
Yes.
So if you go up sometimes and down sometimes, why is that a bad thing overall?
It's not a bad thing overall, Your Honor, and that would, in fact, be the effect of our asymmetrical bandwidth, which the FERC summarily rejected.
Do you have any idea whether this evens out over the period or not, over the last 10 years?
Over the last 10 years, we think that 10 years is too short a period to look at, that it needs to be a longer period of time. And, the studies that were in this case were started in 1982 and ended in 2002 or 3, I believe. And we believe that when you look at the disparities over that period of time and the pendulum swings, the system is still in rough equalization.
Even with the rounding up, we have run out of your time. So thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Issue Idalia Distinction, Mr. Fontham for the LPSC, Ms. Perry for the FERC.
May it please the Court, Mike Fontham again for the Louisiana Public Service Commission. The energy system consists of literally scores of resources, generating units, purchases, some generators built before there ever was a system agreement, some resources acquired by merger, one acquired in a fraud litigation settlement, purchases acquired under any number of circumstances. All are considered system units. All are used for the system. All have been included at full cost in every production cost calculation that was ever made until this case. Yet the FERC distinguished and broke out and excluded from equalization the Vidalia hydroelectric purchase of ELL, based entirely on fallacious reasoning and going against the decision of the administrative law judge for the purpose of artificially reducing ELL's production costs by about $75 to $100 million a year. I'd like to briefly address two or three important facts and then the FERC's rationale. I think the rationale is reviewed for abuse of discretion, but you consider, I hope I'm doing better this time, Judge, but you consider the findings of the ALJ, which are in the record and are very detailed and precise on this point.
And what are we to do if the commission finds things differently than the ALJ?
If they have substantial evidence to support it, then you affirm them. If they don't have substantial evidence to support it, then you reverse them. And they do not have substantial evidence to support this
really
decision.
The test is the same as if the ALJ had been on the same page they were. The fact that the ALJ differs from them is really immaterial.
I think there needs to be a reason. As an example, if the ALJ hears Mr. Gallagher say in the trial,
substantial evidence standard would apply either way, would it not?
I think it's the same standard, but I know that the cases say you do, since the ALJ's decision is in the record, you do consider it in determining whether the FERC's decision is reasoned decision-making. I'm not trying to say the standard changes.
Okay.
The Vidalia hydroelectric purchase was a hydroelectric purchase that was brought, first of all, that was planned at a time when the operating companies had their own planning departments. They planned on the basis of showing that there's an economic benefit for our operating company, and they brought those economic studies to the local regulator. That's the way it was always done. That's the way it was done with Vidalia. They brought it to the LPSC twice. The first time it was rebuffed. The second time, the LPSC was presented with a study that showed there would be a huge detriment on the front end because avoided costs would be lower than the rate path, but a big payoff on the back end, and there would be billions of dollars of savings over the life. The LPSC approved it. It did not grant fuel clause recovery at that time. ELL then executed the contract. The operating committee put Vidalia into the Generation Addition Plan, and the operating committee later approved Vidalia for system equalization in the Billings, which all the witnesses said is the sine qua non of operating committee approval for a system resource. You look at I've tried to list the FERC rationales. The LPSC decided to build Vidalia, a false statement. They admit that on page 62 of their brief, although it's indirect. Mr. Collin of the LPSC admitted the operating committee did not approve Vidalia. That's an incorrect statement. If you read his testimony, he says they did approve Vidalia in the same way they approved any other resource acquisition at that time. They said Mr. Gallagher of Entergy said the operating committee did not approve Vidalia. In pre-filed testimony, that statement appears. When he appeared at the hearing, he said, well, putting it in the generation plan is an official approval. MSS1 billing credit is official approval. On page 1401 and 1402, in 1401, unfortunately didn't get in the appendix, but I asked him, isn't it MSS1 approval? He says, yes. On the next page, he says, yes, they got MSS1 approval. And two other members of the operating committee testified to the same thing. In fact, the chairman of the operating committee at the time said, yes, we did approve it because you couldn't get into the Billings and the generation plan without approval. They say Vidalia wasn't part of a nuclear strategy. Can you imagine? There's probably 50 resources that weren't part of a nuclear strategy. You don't have to be part of a nuclear strategy to be a system unit. They said the LPSC relied on an ELL-specific study. There's detailed testimony in the record that that was the way it was always done, and it's also conceded by all the parties that no other regulator approves the prudence, or at that time, approved the prudence of a resource in a particular jurisdiction. That's the norm. It's not a distinguishing factor. They said that the LPSC gave fuel clause recovery of the total cost of Vidalia. The cost of Vidalia is an ascending rate path. If you put it into base rates, you'd have to have a base rate case virtually every year to recover it. They wanted to put it in an automatically adjusting rate path, and that's what the LPSC agreed to do. The LPSC never said that Louisiana would pay the total cost of the rate of the Vidalia in the sense of it won't be equalized. It was always equalized. The other ratepayers always contributed to the cost of Vidalia under the MSS1 billings to the tune of millions of dollars. The LPSC ratepayers paid the net after the credit under the system agreement. It's a false predicate. They said that tax benefits for Vidalia that were on the operating company books of ELL were flowed through to Louisiana ratepayers. Yeah, who would you flow it through to? There was no equalization tariff that captured tax benefits and the investment that goes with tax benefits. Who would you flow it through to? Now, with an equalization tariff, if it's included at its proper cost, which it should be, the tax credit would flow through, as the ALJ said. And we get to the real reason, well, there'll be cost shifts if we include Vidalia. There is not one reason, I think I've identified every one, that is not a completely fallacious reason or it is based on a false predicate. You can't have reasoned decision making if you go through and you pick out a little point. Well, it's not a nuclear plant. So what? So what? And this was done just to tamper down the remedy, just as the plus or minus 11% was done. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
The Commission's fundamental finding with respect to the Vidalia Hydroelectric Project was that it was not entered into to benefit the energy system as a whole, but to benefit Louisiana. And this is at Joint Appendix 314 and Opinion 480. The Commission found that the capacity was small and the costs were significant, and it was never part of the system planning, and it was not equitable that the cost should be spread throughout the energy system under those circumstances. And that was the commission's basic finding, and it was based on substantial evidence. The commission went through in some detail all of the findings made by the administrative law judge, discussed them all, and made contrary findings with regard to the manner in which the Vidalia project was initiated, the manner in which it was conducted, the reasons for it being built, and who was expected to pay for it, and reached a conclusion based on substantial evidence that it was not appropriate to spread the cost of Vidalia through the Entergy system.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Your time is a maximum, not a minimum. Thank you, Council. Okay, what's the next issue? I believe you were out of time, Council.
Your Honor, I don't have rebuttal to that.
You don't have any rebuttal time, so we're on the next issue, right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Good.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, you're here.
Timing ripeness. Mr. Fontham for the LPSC, Ms. Perry for the FERC.
We have to have a very hard time keeping up with who's who and what they're doing up at the moment. So we're on the last issue, the next to the last person to speak to us, I believe.
I'm sure you're disappointed.
We haven't started your time yet. I'm not using it up. I'm just making sure that we have the scorecard straight as to who's pitching and what inning they came in. And
okay, Judge.
You can proceed.
May it please the Court, Mike Fontham again for the Louisiana Commission.
You're still Mike Fontham. We'll go along with you.
Well, I'm more bruised each time, though.
All right, go ahead.
On June 1, 2005, the FERC found that costs allocations on the energy system were unreasonably discriminatory, and it said in multiple places in its decision a remedy is needed to cure the undue discrimination. And yet it enacted a remedy that did not take effect to change the cost allocations in any way until sometime in 2007. This action goes against the statutory mandate and the decision in LPSC 2. And it is not under reconsideration in the compliance case. The FERC found that a remedy was needed, but it went through an artifice. It said, well, we're going to adopt a formula rate, but guess what? We'll have to wait for a future test year to occur, 2006. And then we'll have to wait to accumulate data in that test year for 2006. And then we'll allow billings to occur. That is against the universal practice with regard to formula rates at the FERC. No utility has ever waited a year and a half for the billings to start because of the need to be prospective. The FERC has never waited for nearly 2 years for billings to start because of the alleged need to be prospective. The formula operates as the rate. It's prospective from the time it starts. It doesn't matter if it's historic data or some other data that populates the formula. That's the practice.
Can I just ask, in light of what they've held now on remand in the other case?
Yes, sir.
What do you think the right resolution is?
It's to reverse, and much the same has happened in LPSC 2. In other words, in LPSC 2, you had basically the same deal.
We remanded and asked for an explanation as to why they didn't give a refund.
I don't think on that one. I think on the refund you did, but I think on the timing it was reversed and rendered. Uh-huh.
But their argument for why not to give with respect to the timing was that it would amount to a refund, right?
That's correct.
Just hold for one second.
Yes,
right?
Sure.
So if their argument that they can't give refunds is gone, that element of the art, or it seems to be being reconsidered, shouldn't we be sending both of these back for them to explain how both the timing and the refund can be explained or not explained?
Okay, the refund issue, the Section 206 issue where you have the holding company exception, that applies to 2001 and 2002, a designated refund effective period. That's over there. The timing issue relates to a formula that could have been put in on June 1, 2005.
I understand that. All I'm saying is it wasn't one part of their explanation for why they couldn't do that was that it would amount to a refund.
And that's what I just addressed. That was their explanation, that in order for it to be prospective, you had to wait for the data. But that's already been resolved by this court, because that's the same thing they said in LPSC 2. You have to wait for 12 months of peaks to come along, take the interruptible load out 1 month at a time as those peaks come along, and then you'll have your full remedy. And this court said you cannot do that. You cannot delay.
It's a rate calculation based on data commencing with the time of the finding of the rate being unlawful because it's unfair and
Right, but generally, Judge, the formula goes into effect, and it does use prior period data to populate the formula.
I disagree with what you said.
Right.
I was rephrasing, not,
yes,
attempt,
sir.
Not
yes,
attempting
sir.
To disagree.
So, but LPSC 2, therefore, controls this. And, you know, the FERC does not have this under reconsideration. In the compliance case, the FERC had under consideration Energy's request to delay it even more to June of 2007.
Yeah.
And there was a fight about that. But it was never an issue whether you could delay it until 2007. And the reservation of rights that, you know, we reserve our rights now on everything because we're scared to death we'll get caught in the trap. And they said the day after they filed with you, the brief with you, they dismissed our reservation of rights, deprecated it, so they didn't know what it meant, they couldn't understand it, and there was no precedent that would ever allow doing that, and it was going to be rejected.
It means you're trying to cover all parts of your anatomy.
That is very true.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. I think your time is up.
Thank
now
you,
we'll hear from the respondent.
It is actually not the case that they have not raised this issue in the compliance proceedings.
Before we get to that, what about their argument that LPSC 2 deals with the timing question?
Well, Your Honor, our point is that all of these issues are pending before the Commission in the compliance proceedings.
Forget that one for a moment and address the question, why doesn't LPSC 2 cover the issue here?
Well, because the Commission addressed this in opinion 480, because the commission's point was it's an annual remedy. It was based on calendar year data, and so the perspective applying it prospectively as soon as possible.
How do you distinguish it from LPSC 2?
Well, because in LPSC 2 they were talking about a monthly calculation.
Well, what does it matter if it's monthly or annual? The same law applies, does it not, that when you found the rate to be an unlawful rate, the remedy should begin from that point, shouldn't it?
Well,
and
the remedy
you do the calculation, whether it's annualized or monthly, you're calculating on data accumulated from that point, aren't you?
The Commission's point was that because it is an annual remedy, if they awarded a remedy for any period prior to 2006, it would have to
when involve
refunds.
When did they make
refunds?
The finding that the rate was unlawful, unfair, whatever the right terminology is?
In 480, Your Honor, in June.
When? June, right.
Right.
In June.
Why yes,
isn't that the date from which the data should be accumulated, just as counsel suggested, for the calculation of rate? Once the formula is known, why isn't it applicable from that date?
Because it's an annual formula, Your Honor, which means
what
that for
difference
half of
does that make from a monthly
well,
formula?
Well, because giving relief for half of 2005 would necessarily be retroactive relief, which the Commission found it could not
give. It's not retroactive from the date of the finding, though. It's retroactive to the date of the finding. It's prospective if your data is accumulated after that date, isn't it?
Not, Your Honor, if you give relief for 2005 because it's an annual remedy, the first 6 months of 2005, that's retroactive relief because the Commission didn't find it unjust and unreasonable until June, and so giving relief from January to June of 2005 is retroactive relief, which is what the Commission...
Can the data not be sorted or mathematically divided based on that June date?
Your Honor, everything, all of the exhibits in this case were based on the Form 1 data. Because this involves all of the total production costs of all of these companies, the remedy is based on the annual filing of the financial statement,
why,
the
why
Form 1 data.
Why wouldn't the appropriate way of dealing with that be to use the fraction of the year, approximately 50%, that is post-finding as against the part that's pre-finding, and apply the rate to that much of the cost? That doesn't seem to me like an impossible calculation. I don't understand the Commission's point.
Well, Your Honor, in the compliance proceeding, these issues have been covered, and there has
been... We're not in the compliance proceeding. That's
a
different argument, and I'm not sure that I ever understood why we couldn't decide this issue in this case without regard to the compliance proceeding.
Because the commission has now, because what the commission said, essentially, in opinion 480 and 488, is not the final word on remedies in this case.
Well,
because of the
is there anything, can you point me to any words in 480 or in the rehearing that suggested that it was still going to reconsider either the timing or the refunds? Certainly not the way I read those opinions.
No, Your Honor, but in the compliance proceeding, as to which there is already a separate appeal pending, the commission has already said...
At the point, there's a separate appeal pending? I mean, once the agency says, this is our decision, and denies rehearing, the party has a right to appeal. Mm-hmm. And you can't come back later and say, oh, by the way, we're going to reconsider this here.
Well, the commission is actually reconsidering it in the compliance proceeding after having had...
Reconsidering those issues?
Yes, Your Honor, in the Louisiana...
Could they get in the compliance proceeding the relief they're asking for here?
Yes, Your Honor. The commission is going to answer the question about what happens with respect to relief prior to 2006, which is the question that they said was precluded because they didn't believe they could give retroactive relief, and now they know that they can, given the results in the LPSC case, and they're going to revisit that
issue. That being the case, or if that's the case, why should we not at the very least vacate what the commission has said about the date, the applicability of the date in this proceeding, at the very least vacate it? Since you are now saying that they're going to reconsider it in some other proceeding, why isn't the result of that, instead of saying we can't hear it, the result of that, why shouldn't that be that we should vacate it?
Well, because, Your Honor, the commission is already addressing the issue in a subsequent proceeding, and we don't know what
the
result.
If that's the case, then why shouldn't we vacate this one? Well, what have you lost by us vacating it in this one?
Well, the commission has it. Let me say this. In the compliance proceeding where all of this is going on, Entergy has filed a request for rehearing that challenges the commission's determination that it now can grant refunds under 206C. So we don't know how it's going to come out. And it's not, so there's no.
But why shouldn't we leave aside the vacate versus remand issue? Why shouldn't we say that the decision about refund, in this case, let's talk about the refund one, for exactly the reason we gave in LPSC 2, is an insufficient explanation, and therefore we remand it for the agency to either change its position or come up with an explanation. And we don't actually care what kind of proceeding you do that in, except you have to do that. You agree that LPSC 2 governs the refund issue, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So we can't uphold this opinion based on the reasoning given in this opinion. It's the same as the reasoning given in LPSC 2, right?
Right, Your Honor, but what you can do is find that it's premature because the commission hasn't given the final word yet on this issue.
It looked final at the time, right?
What's the difference to the commission whether we say it's not premature or we say it's not good enough and we send it back for reconsideration? What's the difference to the commission whether we call it not premature or we say that what's in this opinion is not good enough, since there's nothing in this opinion different from LPSC 2. What's the difference to you?
The difference is just a question, Your Honor, of having the opinions be reversed based on this issue, which is still open before the commission in the compliance
proceedings.
Okay,
you agree with respect to timing also, that the timing issue rests at least in part on a premise that you can't give retroactive relief.
That's right, Your Honor.
And in light of what we said in LPSC 2 with respect to refunds, that is that your explanation for why you can't give retroactive relief wasn't good enough, that also can't stand by itself. That the timing, explanation of timing in this opinion can't stand because it's based on a premise that we've already said was unsatisfactory.
I wouldn't agree with that, Your Honor, because it goes back to the issue of it being an annual remedy. And
that's a different argument. My question is, part of the reason why you said you had to set the time when you did was otherwise it would be retroactive, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's right, Your Honor.
And we can't uphold that anymore because we have another opinion of another panel saying that's not good enough. Now, maybe you have another reason, but that reason's not good enough.
Well, but, Your Honor, there is more explanation than that in Opinion 488. If you look at Joint Appendix at 358, paragraph 54, the commission explains The equalization payments beginning in 2007 were not delayed implementation. It was on a prospective basis after a full calendar year of data. Using the first calendar year was the most appropriate and equitable implementation. They addressed the timing argument in that paragraph, and it doesn't just go to the issue of whether it's retroactive relief.
It doesn't just go to it, but it also does go to retroactive relief, doesn't
yeah.
it?
But this is an independent basis.
Really?
On the
where's the word independent basis in the opinion? Where, yeah. How do we know from the, I think you're right. If the commission said we have two independent grounds, then we could uphold it. But under
well,
Chenery,
then we could consider upholding could, it.
Consider upholding it, correct. But under Chenery, if you give two reasons, we don't know which of the two is correct or is the one that the agency based its decision on.
Or if one's enough by itself. We don't know that.
Well,
so what page are you on now?
I'm Joint Appendix at 358, paragraph 54.
354.
Oh, 358, Joint Appendix 358, and it's paragraph 54.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the commission discusses that the reason why it implemented it as it did, based on a full calendar year of data, it was the most appropriate and equitable implementation. It doesn't have anything to do with the retroactivity. That's a separate point.
Ms. Ferry, is there any chance that the commission here in the compliance proceedings will find that refunds here are impermissible? Is there any chance of that after LPSC 2?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because Entergy clearly thinks that there is a possibility of
everything
that. They filed for rehearing on that.
Everything you say seems to point toward us sending this back for the commission to look its CAFE over, because every time we ask you something that would seem to give us perhaps a way to make a decision, you have to say honestly that you don't know. And that I'm not being critical of you. I'm simply suggesting that I don't see why there is any harm to the commission from us. Now, we may get an argument between ourselves on vacating and just remanding, but what have we done to you if we say, look, we've all found out about LPSC 2. Reconsider this. We can't uphold it on the basis you've given us.
I understand that, Your Honor, but Judge Garland was also talking about eliminating the time or remanding the timing issue on an insufficient yes. basis for making the determination that of
right.
using
and
the calendar year
yes.
starting in 2006,
and
there's separate
yes.
justification.
Well,
for that
question is there separate justification? In the you cited paragraph 54. That's upholding paragraph 53.
Yeah, it begins with any equalization payments would then be made in 2007. It's flowing from the paragraphs before it. It's not independent language.
And paragraph 53, which cites opinion 480 at 145, in 145 it relies on the commission's holding unambiguously that refunds are prohibited. And the place where the commission made that finding has been reversed for lack of sufficient explanation. So it seems like this is based also on a structure that mm-hmm. we've reversed. I'm not sure whether I have to look to see what the disposition was and was whether it was reversed or just remanded. I don't recollect, actually. But in any case, it seems like you have to reconsider this issue. And I don't understand why it matters. You say you can do it in the compliance proceeding. I don't see why. If you're going to reach the same result anyway, why you would have any difficulty with us sending it back for an explanation or for a change of decision?
It just doesn't seem that it's necessary, Your Honor, given the fact that it's already under consideration in the compliance proceeding, and the commission has said it's already under consideration in the compliance proceeding.
Are you really saying to us, I don't have the authority to concede this point, but suggesting that maybe you would if you had that authority? I'm not trying to get you in trouble with the commission, but we're not hearing any good reason offered as to why we shouldn't vacate or remand, at least give it back to the commission in some fashion to reconsider this question.
I take it what we
given
did.
Given LPSC 2.
What we did in LPSC 2 is grant the petition and remand. That's what we did. And I don't
know. Reconsideration of the interpretation of the statute.
Well, apparently is some disagreement among all the parties and FERC as to what we did, and it's not our job to decide that issue here, but it is clear from the opinion that the FERC's decision upon which this opinion is based was insufficient. And that being the case, you're going to have to explain yourself as to whether you have another ground or whether you want to change your mind.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's exactly what the commission is doing. As soon as the remand came down, the commission issued an order saying we have to address this issue further in light of the remand in the LPSC case. But again, I mean, there is the issue of the timing is a separate portion of that, which has nothing to do with the retroactivity.
Well, FERC could say that, but that's not what they've said so far. So far, they've said we can't give prospective relief, number one, and number two, this is the most equitable solution. Now, maybe you think that this is the most equitable solution is an independent ground, but FERC didn't say that. And this is this is like Administrative Law 101. When the agency gives a decision like this, Chenery requires us to send it back or to reverse it or to vacate it or do any number of things, but we can't uphold it. When one of the grounds given, we've already held, is insufficient. We just don't have a choice about this. And what I don't see is an explanation for why it matters whether we say, I mean, unless you think FERC is getting a bad report card for, once again having not explained itself. But it's the same failure to explain. It's not a different failure. So yeah. You can count this as just one. You don't have to count this as different.
We would not have been surprised to see a filing from FERC saying we now concede that issue.
I agree.
We didn't get one, but we would not have been surprised to have seen one.
Council, I don't think it's counsel's fault, by the way.
We're not blaming you. You're not the commission. You're just the one who has to catch javelins for them when you come over here. So your time is long since up, and we've used it all and then some. So thanks to all counsel, and the case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until Monday morning at 9:30 a.m.